Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
Whistling Pines, Chapter 13. I was staring at the May schedule, my mind cluttered with the scattered comments about Bert Sugarman's buggy eyes and visions of Miriam racing through the lobby shouting profanities. None of the dots were connecting across any of my discussions with the residents. Added to my discomfort was the ongoing discussion about bagpipes and my embarrassment over getting caught viewing the phone sex website. My concentration was broken by the sound of someone clearing her throat. Standing at my door was a woman whose stature must have garnered stares wherever she went. "Are you Peter?" she asked. She was well over 6 feet tall, had hair so big it would be the envy of many country music stars, and was more than full-figured. She was made up to look younger, but the crow's feet around her eyes and the furrowed brow said she was closer to her 50th birthday than the 40th. She wore a loose sweatshirt that failed to hide her expansive bosom, a pair of jeans that appeared to be a size too small highlighted her curves. Her fingernails were long and painted an ungodly shade of pink that matched her lipstick. "Excuse me," she said, "my eyes are up here." She pointed to her face, which brought me to a full Norwegian blush. This wasn't a warming of the cheek or pinkness of the cheeks. This was the full fire engine red flaming of the face. "Sorry, I was trying to see." "I know what you were trying to see. What I was hoping to see was someone named Peter who was working on arrangements for my father's funeral." "I'm sorry that we got off to a bad start," I said, pushing myself out of the chair and offering a handshake. "I'm Peter." She took my hand briefly, with a look that said she thought I'd been picking up after Tucker with bare hands. "Just tell me what's going on with the funeral, and I'll get the hell out of here, and you can get back to—" She looked at the pile of papers scattered across my desktop. "So you can get back to whatever it is that you can accomplish in this pigsty." I flashed back to condescending discussions I'd had with Axel and realized that this apple hadn't fallen far from the tree. "Well, we've got the minister and the Lutheran church set up for Friday afternoon at 2. Wendy, our assistant director, is going to sing a solo, and we're working on plans for the processional and recessional. Do you have any thoughts about whether the family would prefer traditional or contemporary music?" Her eyes narrowed. "You didn't mention bagpipes." I didn't know that your father liked bagpipes." "Everyone's been telling me that you've got bagpipes lined up for the funeral." "Well, I made a couple calls, but I don't think that we'll be able to get a piper lined up on such short notice." The blonde Amazon crossed her arms across her ample chest. "My father hated bagpipes. I don't know what kind of loony bin you run here." She let that sink in for a second and then added, "But my father's army unit was camped next to a company of Canadians in Korea, and he said he got so sick of hearing them marching to the bagpipes that he threatened to burn the pipes when they were out on patrol." "So we're clear on the bagpipes," I said. Quickly sorting through a small pile of papers, I came up with a list of songs that Wendy and I had developed for a funeral in our chapel the previous month, and I offered them to her. "The top songs are traditional hymns, and the lower section is contemporary. What guidance would you offer on behalf of the family?" "My father was a rat," she said, eyeing the paper like it also had been soiled. "I wouldn't waste a hymn on him. For that matter, you'd better check the foundation of that church, because it's likely to crack when you wheel his casket in." She threw the list of songs my direction, turned and stepped out of the office, then hesitated and turned back to me. "On second thought, get the bagpipes. I'll pay whatever it costs. I'm sure it'll make him turn in his grave. I'd also suggest that you contact the mortician and have him put a stake in Axel's heart just so he doesn't rise in protest during the service." He wanted to be cremated, I said. Of course he wanted cremation. It's the cheapest, she said. I told the funeral director to put him in the most expensive casket he could find and put it in a lead-lined vault. That ought to put a grimace on his face for eternity. With that, she spun around and disappeared. Wendy stuck her head in the door. Who was the blonde lardbull with an attitude? Axel's daughter, I replied. I'm not entirely sure why she stopped by. She wanted to know about the funeral arrangements, but really didn't want to give me any input. So what did she say? Wendy asked. I think she wanted to rant about what a stinker her father had been. Wendy lurched forward into my office, then spun around, looking annoyed. Maud Thebo pushed her walker into the cramped office, striking Wendy in the shins. Was that Christine, Axel's daughter? She asked loudly. Yes, I replied as Wendy rubbed her shin. Do you know her? Oh, no, I only heard Axel telling people that his daughter had a gland problem and that she got really big. That was one big girl that came out of here. She had boobs the size of watermelons. Does she live nearby? I asked, hoping to redirect the conversation. Maud looked at me as if I were a slow child. She's the bimbo who runs Axel's bar downtown. My nephew was there when she ran a bunch of Hell's Angels out one night when they got lippy. She sat on one of them and almost suffocated him before the cops showed up. I guess it was pretty pathetic seeing this big biker guy with leather and tattoos thanking a cop for saving him. What do Axel's other children do? Wendy asked. Well, he's got a son named Daryl, or Darren, who's a diesel mechanic on the iron range. He wasn't much of a student, so Axel didn't trust him to do anything responsible, like running the bar. The other son is an accountant who runs Axel's apartments. His name is Donald. He was a really good math student, and I hear that he runs the apartments with an iron fist, just like his father. Where does Axel own apartments? I asked. Oh, all over the place. He'd find people who were going bankrupt or were having some financial problems, and he'd scoop them up for pennies on the dollar. I heard that he bought one from a drug dealer who had to get quick cash to take a trip. It sounds like Axel was quite a wheeler and dealer, Wendy commented. Maud turned her walker to face Wendy. Axel was an outright bastard who took advantage of people. Compared to Axel, a used car salesman looks like Mother Teresa. He didn't just use people, he relished the victory and would rub people's noses in it for years. My mind quickly ran through the new list of people who could be suspects. Len Rents would have to run through piles of property records to see who Axel might have scammed over the years. Is there someone who got burned worse than the others? I asked. Maud thought for a few seconds. I suppose it would be Elmore Grant. I heard that he lost his house when Axel bought the contract for deed from an estate. Elmore had missed a couple of payments, so Axel went to the heirs and offered them a couple $1,000s for the contract. They jumped at the chance for quick cash, and the next day Axel was in court having Elmore's family evicted. Elmore committed suicide the next week and left his widow Dottie with four kids, who had no option other than moving in with her brother and sister-in-law. So where is Elmore's widow now? Wendy asked. You know her, Dottie Hathaway in room 316. She remarried a few years after the whole fiasco. I was at a loss for words. Dottie was a mousy woman who shunned nearly all the others and rarely participated in any activities unless she was virtually dragged along. She was independently mobile, but certainly not someone I could visualize sticking a knife into Axel. Then a blinding flash of the obvious struck me. Maud, are Dottie's children still in the area? Maud and Wendy both gave me the slow child look, one that I seem to be getting way too often since Axel's death. Peter, can you recall Dottie ever having a visitor? Wendy asked. Well, I guess that I haven't seen anyone visiting her. Maud leaned heavily on the walker with her left hand and started counting off the children on her right fingers. The oldest boy was killed in a motorcycle accident when he was 16. The second boy had some sexual identity problems and moved to San Francisco. The third was a daughter who claimed that her mother had driven her father to drink, and that's what led to his eventual suicide. She married the assistant manager at the hardware, Hank, and moved to Omaha when he got to manage stores of his own. The youngest was another son who moved to Minneapolis and hasn't been north of the I-694-494 loop around the Twin Cities since he left. I hate to break up this gathering, Kathy, who'd snuck up behind us, said, but I got an email from the guy who runs our server. Peter, it appears that you've become suddenly popular and your electronic mailbox is overflowing. He said that the synthesized female voice on your computer has gone hoarse from saying, you've got mail, so often. The Canadian Piper probably got you with a spyware program, Wendy offered, looking at the computer. I hope you didn't have any credit card information or your social security number in a file anywhere. My cell phone buzzed and I looked at the 800 number on the caller ID that meant nothing to me. I could see that it annoyed Kathy, so I dismissed the call. I'll deal with the emails, I said. The phone buzzed again. Caller ID showed the same number. I pressed talk. This is Chase Bank making a courtesy call on your Visa account. We've picked up an unusual level of activity and wanted to verify that it was indeed you who was initiating all the charges. My mind was reeling with the possibilities. It could be a scammer trying to get my account information. It could be someone calling as a practical joke. It could be legitimate. Could you tell me what the last charges were? I asked. The last charge was for a horse and saddle in Craig, Colorado, and the charge before that was for an antique silver tea set from somewhere in Ireland. The voice hesitated. Do you want to know about any more of the charges? No, that's fine. The last legitimate charge should be at Edgar's gas station in Two Harbors, Minnesota, about 2 days ago, I said. I quickly ran through other possible purchases, but most had been paid for in cash or by check. The charges you mentioned were not any that I made. Can you put a hold on the card or cancel it? Certainly, the pleasant voice said. Can you verify your identity by giving me the last 4 digits of your Social Security number and your mother's maiden name? I supplied my mother's maiden name and was assured that I wouldn't be responsible for any of the bogus charges. Whistling Pines, Chapter 14. So are you an expert in computer hacking? I asked Wendy, who was sitting at my computer, her fingers flying over the keys. Not really, she replied. I just spend a little time following some of the news and reading online security tips. When was the last time you let the system update your antivirus software and malware protection? Huh? I thought all that happened automatically. Wendy continued to type. It does an automatic update, but you have to accept it. Is that the annoying pop-up that asks me if I can shut down and reboot? That would be the one. Her fingers danced over the keys and then came to a sudden stop. Uh-oh, I don't know where you've been on the internet, but you're getting slammed with spam. What? I asked as I bent down to look at the screen over her shoulder. The email counter said I had 999 waiting messages. The number was pulsating, and I had a sick feeling that each pulse represented an attempt to add more charges to my charge card. The screen changed as Wendy sped between sites and views. I think you maxed out the available memory on the server when you got to 999 messages. There, I reset the maximum inbox size. She stopped at another screen, and I watched as the computer pinged as new messages blinked up on the screen faster than a stock exchange ticker. Man, look at those subject lines, I said, as a string of emails scrolled down the screen. Most were offering Viagra or some kind of male enhancement aids, followed by travel offers, information on cremation services, fake Rolex watches, and resale of timeshare condos. Wendy's fingers spun their magic once again, and the list stopped. Suddenly, the numbers dropped in increments of hundreds. I started to screen the topics by keywords, and the server is blocking some of the most blatant. There, we're down to a mere couple hundred. She heaved herself out of the chair and pushed it over to me. However, if you ever want to order Viagra over the internet, we'll have to change some of the filtering. She gave me a sly smile and added, "You don't need Viagra, do you?" "Believe me," I said, pointing to the door, "you will not be the first person I come to with that problem." I looked at the smaller list and still saw dozens with bagpipes in the subject line. Wait, how did I get on the list for all these bagpipe emails? Wendy stepped back into my tiny office and looked at the screen. "Go to your outbox." When I clicked on the sent icon, a list of my recent outgoing correspondence popped up. I didn't send many emails, so I was surprised to see more than a dozen with today's date. I quickly scanned the list of subjects and recipients. "I didn't send any of these," I said, pointing to the screen. "Do you have a password on your screensaver?" Wendy asked. My blank look answered her question, and she quickly took over the keyboard again. Within seconds, we were prompted for a password. Wendy looked at me expectantly. "How about Jenny?" I asked. I was getting very tired of the slow child look. "What?" I asked defensively. "Passwords are worthless if any idiot can guess them. You need something that's not obvious and not personal. It's even better if you put some special symbols or numbers into them." "Special symbols, like smiley faces?" I got the look again as she pointed to the symbols above the numbers at the top of the keyboard. I contemplated the option for a moment. "Make it STAR asterisk POUND hatch," I said. "Not very creative," she said as she keyed in my new password, "but if you can remember that, it works." I reclaimed my chair and computer and quickly scanned the outgoing emails again, opening two with the subject bagpiper. To my horror, I saw that whoever had been on my computer had offered up my credit card number with an expiration date. I quickly went back through outgoing emails and found one that I'd sent with credit card information to secure a reservation for a weekend trip that Jenny and I had made to Grand Marais. The thief had been in my computer's memory, and I'd been too trusting. Leaving the computer without password protection had been like leaving an open checkbook to cyberspace. Whistling Pines, Chapter 15. Having lost most of the afternoon on the computer, I went looking for Jenny after shutting down the computer and locking my office. That alone was no easy feat because I had to search for 10 minutes to find the key that had never previously been in the lock. Such is the level of trust in Two Harbors and Whistling Pines. Of course, it was all for strangers and residents because anyone with a pass key could still enter, and all the staff members had pass keys. Jenny was charting some patient data, oblivious to the world, when I stuck my head into her office. "Hey, do you have any supper plans?" She looked so tired it was concerning. "I guess I hadn't thought that far ahead yet," she said, pushing a stray lock of hair behind her ear. Her desk was piled with patient charts, and I could see a stack of pink note slips left by the housekeeping people and the health aides. Behind her was a locked gray cabinet that held the medications for the residents who couldn't manage their own dosing. Open patient charts were strewn on a counter on the opposite wall. I thought I'd pick up a couple of Mary Callender turkey pot pies and a half gallon of milk. "Care to join me for a gourmet supper?" I asked, trying to put on my best upbeat persona. Jenny sighed and looked at the chart on her lap. "I don't know, Peter. I just don't think that I can do anything extra tonight. I need to finish up these charts and get home to help Jeremy with his homework." I walked over and set the chart aside before pulling her into my arms. "It's Axel, isn't it?" She nodded. "Half the residents are sad, not that they liked Axel, but any death reminds them of their own mortality," Jenny said, her nose buried in my chest. "The other half are excited about the funeral. It seems so morbid, but I guess they don't register the sadness. They're just excited about an outing with a meal." "Tell you what," I said, holding her by the shoulders. "You finish up here. I'll buy 3 pot pies, and by the time you get to my house, supper will be in the oven, and Jeremy and I will be grinding through pre-algebra. Deal?" All Jenny could muster was a weak smile and a nod. Jenny and Jeremy live with her parents in a newer house with a brick facade and a cement driveway, which puts them much further up the food chain than most of the people in town. Pulling into their driveway always made me feel like I was going to meet June and Ward Cleaver. No paint was peeling, the lawn was lush and never in need of mowing, and arborvitae bushes on either side of the front steps were always neatly trimmed and symmetrical. Barbara, Jenny's mother, met me at the door before I'd climbed the first of the 3 steps, as she always did. It's surreal, like she has an early warning system, or maybe she sits at the front window all day long, watching the wide avenue that goes through their development. Barbara was trim with many facial features that had been passed on to Jenny. She was dressed in a pair of khaki slacks that looked like they might still be warm from the iron. Her white blouse was accented with a string of black pearls that I suspected were from Tahiti. As always, her makeup was perfect and her nails manicured. "Peter, how nice to see you," she said as she stepped back from the door to let me into the house, carefully giving no hints that a hug might be welcome. The tone of her voice didn't match her words. "Jeremy is gathering his books. I suspect he'll be down in a moment." I stood on the marble tiles in the entryway next to the neat row of carefully polished shoes that were always left at the door, never to stray onto the white carpet. The exception to the rule was a pair of stained Nike basketball shoes with flagging laces that had been shed haphazardly on the seam of the carpet and tile. Jeremy obviously ignored the strict order of the household, although he had capitulated to the requirement to remove his shoes. I was about to comment about the cool weather, that being an always safe topic, when I heard the rumble of running feet above me. Within seconds, Jeremy was bouncing down the steps 2 at a time with a backpack slung over one shoulder. "Jeremy, you'll ruin your back if you don't put both straps on your shoulders," Barbara scolded. Jeremy jammed his feet into the shoes and pushed past me. "Okay, Grandma," he muttered in passing. I watched him race to my car. Barbara sighed as she watched him leave. "I'm too young to have a teenage grandchild and too old to keep up with him." She turned to me and hesitated. "You know that he thinks the world of you. Please don't disappoint him." "What do you mean?" Barbara put her hand on the door in the international symbol for "You are about to leave now," and took a half breath. "I think you know very well what I mean." With the slightest pressure on my elbow, I was politely ushered out the door. As I walked down the steps, I reflected on the fact that Barbara didn't have a wrinkle or line anywhere on her face. I'd never seen her frown, scowl, or smile. Apparently, that left a person with skin unblemished by the emotions of life. I started to wonder if she was an alien or if she was just on a good regimen of drugs that subdued all her emotions. On the other hand, she had Scandinavian blood coursing through her veins, and their stoicism was nurtured through many generations. I'd attended a gospel concert at the Swedish Lutheran Church one Friday night and was amazed at the congregational lack of response to the rocking beats. A few people were tapping their toes, but I was the only one who actually stood up and started clapping my hands while swaying to the beat. Some choir members joined me after a few bars, but the majority of the folks stayed politely in the seats, content to let the crazy music people swing to the gospel beat.
You've been listening to Episode 7 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the home page. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.
Skin like art, and your breath is hard as kerosene. You weren't your mama's only boy, but her favorite one it seemed. So she began to cry when you said goodbye and sank into your dreams. His horse was fast as polished steel. He wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. Pancho met his match, you know, in the deserts down in Mexico. Nobody heard his dying word. Oh, but that's the way it goes. They could have had him come any day, but only let him slip away. Out of kindness, I suppose. Lefty, he can't sing the blues all night long like he used to. The dust of Pancho bit down south. Ended up and left his mouth. Day they laid poor Pancho low. Left his split for Ohio, where he got the bread to go. Ain't nobody know.
I was better, I will say. Slip away out of kindness, I suppose.
Is living in a cheap hotel. The desert's quiet and Cleveland's cold. So the story ends with told. Pancho needs your friends, it's true, but save a few or left it too. Honey did what?